This is a rain rerun.
This rain report will begin in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. How old were you when you became a ham radio operator? I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ. 4 decades ago, a great many hams earned their novice ham call sign in high school. Rain's founder-producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, was 14 and a freshman at Escondido Union High School in Escondido, California, back in 1965. Rich Moseson, W2VU, was a junior at Spring Valley Senior High in Spring Valley, New York, in 1970. Today, Rich is the editor of CQ Magazine and editorial director for both CQ VHF and Popular Communications. Over the next 2 weeks, we'll hear how he got started in ham radio and how ham radio led him to his position with CQ Communications.
I was 15 when I got my license. It was originally WN2QQN, which was and is quite a mouthful. I noticed there's been no line to get that in the vanity call program. I got interested in ham radio through two things that kind of combined with each other. One was Boy Scouts, and the other was CB, like so many thousands and thousands of other hams. My scoutmaster was a CBer. He got my dad and myself interested in it, particularly for keeping in touch with each other on trips to campouts and things. We got interested beyond just the camping trips and started getting active. And pretty soon, it got to be a little limiting. You had your circle of friends that you talked to locally and not much else going on. And I learned about ham radio. It's the late 1960s. Most people were still on AM, or at least enough of them, so that with a shortwave receiver, you could tune in hams without needing to have a BFO for a single sideband. When I was in high school, I was told by a friend of mine who was working on getting his license that there were some hams in the school who were starting up a club, and was I interested? So I figured I'd tag along. There was no station or anything. It was a new club. One of the kids had brought with him a shortwave receiver. We were up in a second floor classroom, and he threw a roll of wire out the window and turned it on. First thing we heard was Radio Tirana in Albania, which at the time was probably the most closed society on the planet. I was hooked instantly. Still enjoy shortwave listening to this day.
And what year are we talking about?
This is 1970. Other kids who were already licensed helped those of us who were interested but not yet ticketed to learn what we needed to learn for the test, and they got a couple of people from one of the local radio clubs to give the novice test to a few of us. I remember that test being incredibly easy. People talk about the test today being easy, not compared to the novice test of 1970. That was easy. These are tough.
How did code come for you?
Code was difficult. Always has been. Probably always will be. I have no end of admiration for people to whom it comes easily. It has never come easily to me. I get on every once in a while just to keep my skill level remotely decent. At that point, it was a 2-year non-renewable license. You had to upgrade or get thrown out of the hobby, which was bizarre if you think about it. It's probably the only hobby in the world that tells you that you have to progress a certain amount within a certain time or you can't do it anymore. In any event, about a year later, I thought I was ready. Went to the FCC in New York, because this is before the days of volunteer examining. Took my code test for general and flunked it by 3 letters. The FCC inspector suggested that I take the written test so that I at least have a permanent license, which I did, and I passed that.
So you actually had a technician license, which in those days you had to have a 5-word-per-minute novice code test under your belt. You had to pass the general theory exam.
Right. It wasn't a good thing for me to do, in one respect, because at that time, technicians had no HF privileges, even with passing a code test. So I was immediately taken off the HF novice code bands, where I could have practiced to get my code speed up a little more so that I could pass the next time I went to take the test.
That seems kind of contrary to the whole point of having you on the bands at 5 words per minute. Increasing your code speed so you could get it faster.
Yep. The result was I got introduced to VHF, which I'm still in love with, particularly 2 meters and 6 meters. This was before the days of FM, well, the very, very early days of FM, but I had a 2-meter AM Heathkit lunchbox, the tour, with crystal control transmit and tunable receiver that was as wide as a barn door. One benefit to that was I was able to tune in these new fangled things called FM repeaters, starting to pop up through slope detection because the passband on the receiver was so wide. But basically, I was on AM, really never got out of the DXing mode on VHF, and still enjoy 2 meter and 6 meter sideband. It was about 4 years before I went to take my test again. And as I recall, I flunked it again. And then another year or two went by before I finally took the code test and passed it and got my general.
We're talking about 1978?
78 or 79.
And how old were you by that point?
Early 20s. In that time period, 2 meter FM repeaters really took off. I was able to get an FM rig and become involved with FM and repeaters. That sustained my interest. I really wanted to get back on HF, but I couldn't. And then in 78 or 79, the FCC changed the rules and gave novice HF privileges back to technicians. I dusted off my old HF transmitter, got back on the air on CW on HF, and that was the only way I was able to then bring my code speed back up to the point where I could pass the code test and get my general.
What was your first ham station?
My first ham station was borrowed. Icos 720 transmitter and Hallicrafter's SX99 receiver, which was a general coverage shortwave receiver. It was a lot better than nothing. I managed to make quite a few contacts with it.
What bands, what antenna?
40 and 15 to start, because you could do it on one antenna, 40-meter dipole. Amazing what you can remember 35 years later. First station I owned was a Hallicrafter's HT40 transmitter that I got as a hand-me-down from a friend who had moved up to single sideband with an HT32, where you had to carefully adjust the carrier balance in order to make sure everything was right. And it was this humongous piece of equipment. And then a Lafayette HA350 receiver. And of course, in those days, you had to carefully adjust your plate tuning. And
you had to dip the plate and paint the grid.
Actually, it may have been the other way around.
That might be why my T150 got fried along the way. And remember how bad the room would smell when you fried a capacitor or a little resistor?
Well, that's because you let the smoke out. You see, capacitors, at least in those days, now they're, you know, surface mount doesn't have much room for them, but they were filled with smoke. And if you shorted it out or another way disturbed it, you let the smoke out, and it didn't work anymore.
What about the resistors, though?
Them, too. They had smoke inside.
Oh.
If you let the smoke out, it doesn't work.
I never knew that. I'm speaking today with Rich Motheson, W2VU, the editor of CQ Magazine and editorial director of CQ-VHF and Popular Communications. We'll be right back. This is the Rain Report.
You're listening to RainReport.com, the only authorized internet source for Rain audio.
In those days, of course, novices had to transmit with crystal control. They didn't have the VFOs that they were able to use later. Do you happen to remember what frequencies your rig was crystalled for, on 40 or 15?
Let's see. The novice band was different in those days than it is now.
It was 7150 to 7200.
Right. I had 7165 and 7170-something, and I may have had a 7156 crystal as well.
7154 is what I had. I grew up in Southern California, and in those days, there was a horrific Russian jammer on 7154 every night. That frequency was pretty well useless. I also had 7164, 7175, 7182 and 7194. Did you ever use a small trimmer capacitor to pull the crystal frequency enough to get away from somebody else whose crystal happened to be transmitting right on your crystal frequency?
I don't remember ever doing that. I was aware of people who could and did do that. The advent of VXOs, variable crystal oscillators, which essentially packaged it for you. You know, hopefully a person who was right on my frequency was also talking to me. You know, in those days, you didn't just listen on your own frequency. You tuned around, and you could talk to somebody who was 10 or 15 kilohertz away.
I'd forgotten that when you called CQ, you actually did tune around as much as 5 or 6 or 7 kilohertz either side, which, of course, made it rough for anyone who wanted to hear both sides of the code contact. Gosh, I'd forgotten all about that. So now we're entering the 80s. What was notable about your ham radio experience in the early to mid-80s, Rich?
Well, in the early to mid-80s, I had my General. I was able to get on a HF phone at that, so I started working a fair amount of DX. It took me 30 years to work DXCC.
100 countries or more.
Yes, confirmed. I've always been a dabbler in ham radio. I've never gotten intensely into any one aspect. I like doing a lot of different things. Packet radio was just starting to come on the scene at that time. I did get pretty heavily involved in packet radio. In fact, that provided my first experience in writing for CQ Magazine. I had just gotten a TNC, which is what you needed to connect between your computer and your radio to do packet.
Terminal node controller, we called them.
Very good. I couldn't figure out how to make it work. I knew I had it all hooked up right. I'm hearing things. I get my CQ magazine in the mail, and it says, Ritty Special with Packet. And I figured, oh, great, I'm going to learn how to use this thing. And I opened it up, and there were two or three articles in there on how it worked, but nothing on how to work it. It had happened that over the last couple of years, I had gotten to know Dick Ross, K2MGA, who's CQ's publisher, and I called him up and said, gee, I was really disappointed. I was looking forward to finding out how to use this stuff that I have that I can't make work. Everything in the magazine just told me how it works, but not how to work it. I said, why didn't you have an article on how to work it? He says, because you didn't write it yet. But I don't know. That's why I need an article. He says, well, you go find out and tell the rest of us. I started taking some phone calls to people who I knew were successfully talking to each other on Packet, put together a two-part article, which turned out to be the first article in any of the major ham magazines on how to actually use Packet. And that's kind of been my guiding philosophy in ham publications and videos, etc., ever since, to focus on how to work it as well as how it works, because it doesn't really do you a whole lot of good to know how something works if you don't know how to use it or what to do with it. You have to know both.
This has been our first installment of an interview Rain's Hap Holly, KC9RP, conducted with Rich Moseson, W2VU, the editor of CQ Magazine and editorial director for both CQ VHF and Popular Communications. We'll conclude Hap's interview with Rich next time. The Rain Report is copyright 1990 through 2007. Rain, all rights are reserved. I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ.